week, WFAE talks voting rights in North Carolina's election overhaul bill. Parts of the law have been the subject of federal court hearings this week. The governor's relationship with state Senate leaders gets awfully frosty. And a blast from the past was on our air this week.
And now, let's have a great big welcome for our host and hostess, Jim and Emmy Baker!
Thank you!
Ah, the memories. But there is a dispute over the unfinished tower on the old Heritage USA PTL property in York County, South Carolina. We'll get to that. Hello, I'm Greg Collard, news director at WFAE, and joining me as usual is reporter Ben Bradford.
Hey, Greg.
Hey. And we're breaking in a new guy in WFAE Talks this week. He's reporter Michael Tomczyk.
First time on WFAE Talks.
I mean, how excited are you on a scale of like one to two excited to remember numbers?
Too excited to remember faces.
Wow.
It's pretty
exciting.
I'm blacking out right now.
So we're in the middle. It's been kind of a weird feel in the newsroom the last couple of weeks. It's kind of, we're in the summer doldrums a little. News is slow. People are in and out on vacations.
Well, the people who generate news are, except with the exception of the state legislature, many of them are also out of town and on vacation.
Exactly. So that affects the news. And then of course, we have our own people on vacation and just has kind of been people coming in and out.
True.
Yeah. So then Lisa Miller is obviously one of those people who are out this
hence
week.
Hence Michael.
Yes, hence Michael.
We're back up.
For the record, I'm only here because Lisa Miller is absent.
I wouldn't say that because if Lisa Miller was here, I probably would have given you the axe this week, Ben. Maybe.
Oh, wow.
Because Michael has been.
Well, there goes Ben and my great relationship. Thanks, Greg.
So it's going to be like that. That's how it's going to be this week.
Well, Ben has been, or not Ben, Michael has been in Winston-Salem all week covering these federal court hearings over the election overhaul bill, the Justice Department's challenge to it. And have you recovered?
I'm getting there. I'm a little bit tired, but honestly, it was a fascinating week. I mean, the court arguments were really interesting to be there for.
So on Monday, it was kind of nutty a little bit. I mean, crazy in that you didn't get into the actual courtroom. Talk a little
exactly
about that. It got off to a rough start.
Right. So, I mean, this is to kind of put this in a little bit of perspective. You can think of what happened this week as the mini trial before the big trial over the Justice Department lawsuit, which is next summer. So next summer, we'll decide if all these changes are constitutional or not. This summer, the question was, are you going to put some of them on hold before you have that final decision next summer?
And to be clear, we're talking about the North Carolina's voting law, this big sweeping voting law.
Yeah, and the changes in question here don't even actually, this summer or this week wasn't even about ID. This was about reducing the early voting period by a week, eliminating same-day registration, and no longer counting ballots that are cast in the wrong precincts.
And that's because voter ID doesn't take effect till 2016,
exactly.
So it wouldn't be in effect for this election.
Right, exactly. And so Monday morning was the first hearing in this, and it's been kind of gearing up for more than a year, I believe. And you had this massive line outside the federal courthouse, and the way they do their security there is it takes forever. And I got there 40 minutes early thinking that would probably be enough time, and it wasn't. I was not able to get in, and there was this long line of people that were not able to get into the courtroom that first day.
And
for the record, I was in the courtroom the rest of the week, so I was actually there for all the arguments. But that first day, we couldn't get in, so I ended up just talking to a lot of people outside of it.
And the reason for that was they were basically holding a rally. It was these Moral Monday protests, right? And they'd organized basically packing the courtroom.
Yeah, there were several. The NAACP had their Moral Monday rally there at the end of the day. And that morning there were, buses that came in from all across the state. I talked to a pastor from Charlotte who came on a bus with some of the members of his church, and they were there to be in the courtroom and hear the arguments.
But the reporters do not get priority, huh? Priority seating.
We do not, which honestly made me feel kind of good because, I mean, it's an open courtroom. In theory, whoever wants to should be able to get in there.
Right.
But there were way more lawyers at all times than any other group of people. It was packed with lawyers.
And see, that's kind of an interesting thing too, because you've been kind of hammering that home that there's all these different groups that are involved in the lawsuits. So the main lawsuit's being brought by the Justice Department, but there are all these other interveners, which are basically other advocacy organizations that have their own legal arguments, and they're kind of different from the main Justice Department argument.
Yeah, the main players in this case are the Justice Department, obviously. Then you have the NAACP has its own lawsuit. Then the League of Women Voters, which then also includes the ACLU and some other groups, they have their own lawsuit. For now, those three lawsuits are working together, You can think of them as basically one lawsuit right now, except they're a little bit different. And then, yeah, on top of that, you'll have these different interveners, and there's still some question as to whether they'll actually get to be part of the case.
And speaking of that, some of these arguments, these other, have been more part of the media discussion than actually what took place in the courtroom.
Exactly. So one thing that's gotten some hype in the media is this idea that there's a challenge about whether North Carolina's election overhaul discriminates against young voters. Mm-hmm. And it's this really new kind of novel argument that these young voters are trying to bring under the 26th Amendment, which is what lowered the voting age from 21 down to 18. And it was being in the courtroom this week. It was so clear that that whole discussion is such a sideshow. I mean, mm-hmm. it's totally a sideshow because the whole case here, the heart of this case, is under the Voting Rights Act and whether or not these changes will discriminate based on will deny or curtail the right to vote based on race. It's purely about race because that's what the Voting Rights Act was all about. So that's the entire focus, and the judge had all these really specific questions about that and trying to get his arms around that. And then every now and then you'd have this really quick little sideshow where another lawyer would get up and talk about the voting age thing. North Carolina's lawyers wouldn't even really respond to anything that he said. The judge kept kind of asking him, you know, are you gonna convince me how you have standing, like why you even can actually join this suit? So the idea as of right now that, you know, the argument over whether this impacts young voters is equal with whether it impacts mm-hmm. African Americans is just totally false. And honestly, I would not be surprised at all if in the judge's decision to this, he just tosses out this young voter claim and says, you don't have standing to be a part of this case as of right now.
Just based on the attitudes that you're seeing in court, not only from the judge, but also the main people in the case, including the people arguing the case.
Totally. I mean, even the other plaintiffs. So, you know, the Justice Department and well, I'm not going to name names. The other plaintiffs, as the lawyer for the interveners was talking, everyone in the courtroom just kind of like rolled their eyes at this point as these people were going. So, I mean, it's totally this sideshow. The heart of this case, what it's going to ultimately come down to is whether or not it discriminates based on race, whether or not African Americans who have disproportionately used early voting and same-day registration and out-of-precinct ballots, whether by changing those things or taking those things away, it then harms their ability to vote. And if that's the case, if the judge finds that there could be irreparable harm in November, then he will put those changes on hold until next summer when there will be a final decision on whether or not this law can stand.
Okay. So do Latinos have standing in this? Other racial groups? I know the NAACP has put out press releases mentioning Latinos and being discriminated against under this, but that's not – other minority groups are not part of this lawsuit either or aren't
– From the Justice Department, from the Justice Department standpoint, the language is literally deny or abridge the right to vote based on race. So you could say – you could put Latinos in or this and that, but the Justice Department has focused its case purely on African Americans. I do think, to your point, Greg, the NAACP and some others have added in some arguments about Latinos, but from everything I heard in the courtroom this week, the focus was on African Americans.
And what's the reason for that?
The focus on African Americans? Yeah. It's all about
they use it so much.
Exactly.
Early voting.
I mean, so there are two ways you can look at this. One way is the amount they use it. So, for example, more than 70% of all African American voters who voted in the past two presidential elections voted early. That compares to about 50% of white voters in the last presidential election. On top of that, you have this idea of this historical disparity we have in North Carolina. I mean, we have a history of discriminating against African Americans and not allowing them to vote. If you look at the numbers over the past decade since North Carolina has started doing early voting and same-day registration and some of these other things, their turnout rates have really increased and are just now kind of getting to a place where they're close to or better than white turnout. So the Justice Department is saying these things are working. African Americans are disproportionately relying on them. So to take them away, that is what would make it discriminatory.
Now, is that because of early voting or is it because of President Obama?
And that is actually a great counterpoint that the state's lawyers raised in these discussions. They said, so Virginia does not have early voting, does not have same-day registration, and its African-American turnout rates have improved quite a bit in over the past two presidential elections. So the state's lawyers were like, how do we know this isn't just what they described as the brilliant Obama campaign doing a better job getting people to turn out?
There's also a case that you brought. We didn't really get into this on the air this week, but Georgia did something similar, but that was found constitutional, but it's a little bit different too.
And that was an important point that the Justice Department raised. So the judge was struggling with if I make this ruling here, does that mean that everyone's going to have to start doing early voting, all the other states? And the Justice Department brought up the example of we cleared Georgia under the Voting Rights Act a couple years ago to cut its early voting period from, I think it was 45 days down to 21 days. And we were cool with that because at the time, Georgia wasn't as reliant on early voting. There was broad bipartisan support for the change. There were African-American lawmakers who were behind the change, said, we think this is going to work. So because of that, the Justice Department said, you know, in that case, a reduction in early voting was okay.
One of the arguments has been that, hey, we didn't reduce early voting. We've just reduced the number of days, but the same number of hours are still there. So has that argument been brought up? How did that wash with the judge?
Absolutely. And the Justice Department really, really tried to hammer home days matter here. It's not about just hours. Days matter. And the reason they tried to hammer that home is you look at, for example, populations that don't have transportation, that have fewer resources. It's easier to kind of figure out ways to do souls to the polls, so where churches will bring people out. You have more days to organize those things. But the justice showed the judge showed some was somewhat skeptical about this. And I mean, one of the questions he came back around to was, how do I know that 10 days of early voting as opposed to 17 won't be enough? How do I know that is going to strain the system? And there were these different reports about that, and there's a lot of different testimony, and the state tried to poke holes in it. And I think it's clearly a question that federal judge Tom Schroeder is struggling with.
So I guess there's certainly a possibility that he can grant some of the motions and not others. Does that seem like a likelihood, or what are your observations after being in court all week?
Judge Schroeder asked a lot of questions, especially during closing arguments, to everybody. And they were relatively evenly divided across the three challenges the Justice Department is bringing. So, you know, early voting, same day registration, out of precinct. But yeah, in theory, he could say, all right, we're going to still count ballots that are cast in the wrong precinct, but make the other changes. He can basically do whatever he wants as far as either upholding all of them, putting some on hold, putting them all on hold. And then the other thing is the NAACP and some of the others are asking for even more changes to be put on hold. So in theory, he could go beyond what the Justice Department is asking, but that at least did not seem likely because the judge asked very few questions about those other things.
Now, we've been covering this a lot through, you know, politicians, or when this bill was being debated and there was a lot of rhetoric on both sides. I'm wondering, was it interesting to cover this where the rhetoric wasn't there, where it was just kind of straight legal and the press statements, the things are going to grab headlines. That's not part of the courtroom. Was it easier to cover it in some ways because of in this and really get down to, I guess, brass tacks on these things?
Absolutely.
To borrow an old fogey term, I guess. was it easier to cover it in this way or more interesting?
It was a lot more interesting. So to be clear, there was still some of the sort of partisan rhetoric because you had some like Democratic lawmakers called this and that to talk about the process. But yeah, I mean, when you're just hearing sort of the legal arguments, I mean, it became a lot more of an interesting look at, especially once something becomes law, there is such a high bar you have to meet to then convince a judge that a state needs extraordinary relief to put these changes on hold. So it was fascinating just to see, you know, how conclusively the plaintiffs have to try to make their case to get a change.
Yeah, because they're not even arguing. I mean, just to be really clear about this, they're not. This particular week is not about the ultimate decision of, you know, does this impact African American voting rights? This is about is it to the extent where the judge has to basically grant an injunction against the law while he takes another look at it?
Yes and no. I mean, this week is about, does it impact African-American voting rights? I mean, they have to prove that African-Americans would be irreparably harmed.
Right, but when you're talking about extraordinary relief, you're not talking about just a decision in a case one way or the other. You're talking about basically suspending it before the sort of larger court case to look at it.
Yeah, but in order to grant that extraordinary relief, the plaintiffs have to show there would be irreparable harm to African-Americans in November. But
right.
Yeah, to your point, though, you know, so if the judge shows that gives you a clue about maybe how next summer could play out, but it's not definitive.
Right.
All right. Well, moving on. Interesting rhetoric coming out of the State House this week. Of course, the legislature, House and Senate have been unable to come to terms on many things in the budget, like teacher raises. Something interesting has developed where there's more of a frosty relationship, I think it's fair to
Some really harsh words coming out. I mean, actually really from all sides.
Between the governor and the Senate leaders particularly.
From the governor and the Senate leaders, yeah. But also remember, I mean, earlier this week, the Senate walked out of a House presentation
on their budget. And the Senate and House divide. And the governor's clearly taken up the House's side.
Right.
And so, yeah, there's a big divide between House and Senate leaders, too.
Yeah.
Having a supermajority. Right?
Yeah, and they're all Republicans. That's what's so fascinating about this. I mean, it seems like it's just as they're at each other's throats just as much as Republicans and Democrats are in some other states.
Let me read something that here's a statement the governor put out yesterday or Thursday in which he promised to veto the Senate's budget or anything resembling it. And one of his comments was, "The Senate is currently standing by themselves with no visible support outside of the beltline of our state capitol." A few hours later, Senate leader Phil Berger put out his own press release, headline, "Berger responds to governor's threat to veto largest teacher raise in state history." And one of the things he said is, "The governor has been unable to sustain any of his previous vetoes in the Senate. It would be more helpful for him to work with members of both chambers of the legislature, since his unwillingness to listen to those who have an honest disagreement with him on spending priorities in favor of staging media stunts and budget gimmicks is a major reason the budget has not been finalized."
Which is great, because, of course, sending out a press release was – what was that headline again?
Berger responds to governor's threat to veto largest teacher raise in state history.
Yeah, to veto the largest teacher raise in state history, because that's clearly what,
that's all of it.
Right. No, but I mean, it's funny because that, of course, is itself like a kind of a classic, this is the sort of your classic political, attack ad, right? Or, I mean, attack press release in this case.
Sure.
And you'd usually see this sort of targeted at the other party. You know, I mean, we see similar things coming out of Tom Tillis's office against Kay Hagan and
sure.
vice versa in the Senate race. So you don't usually think of that happening in the same parties. But I mean, that shows you, I mean, just the extent to which usually in these kind of circumstances, they want to keep that kind of discord under wraps. They want to, go out and work out their differences in private and then come out together and do a unified thing. So it's not to say that you don't have these differences between people in the same party usually. It's just that they have a real incentive, meaning the upcoming elections, to not squabble publicly, and particularly not to burn each other publicly.
Yeah, right? Yeah. There's a lot of animosity going on.
Yeah.
And to be clear, I guess technically that is correct. I assume it's a big 11%. Teacher pay raise, but the Senate has
construction of it.
Yeah,
is,
the teacher tenure issue is an issue. They've agreed to take that provision out. But I don't know where that stands now, to be honest, if that's
remained out. Raise to attach the raise
to teachers opting out of tenure. But then the other big deal is that plan also calls for cutting a lot of teacher assistants, which is a big deal to teachers.
Absolutely.
Can give me a big raise, but make my job harder.
Right. The way that both the governor's plan originally, which is kind of interesting, and it's kind of part of what they're accusing of in there, and then the Senate plan, both the way those were structured was to basically one of the ways to pay for giving teachers the raise was to cut teacher assistants. Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things that the Senate's accusing McCrory of is that he now says he won't go up to a certain point in terms of teacher raises. He won't go above 6% to the 11% raise that the Senate was proposing. And two, he doesn't want to see it tied to cuts to teacher assistance. Mm-hmm. So I think what we're seeing happen here, if you look back to on a national level in it was in, 2009 when the Democrats in Congress, the Democrats had a majority. It's the same. That was when they passed health care. But you think about how they passed health care. They very briefly had could get the supermajority in the Senate. They had 60 votes in the Senate. They had a majority in the House, and they had a Democratic president. But essentially, you could have more major differences break out. So they barely got health care over the finish line, and they didn't do it while they had their 60 votes in the Senate, because essentially you could have larger differences in the plan and people could push in their heels more because they knew they had more leverage. And I think the part of what we're seeing happen here, that's all like a big tangent basically to say, I think what we're seeing happen here is a power struggle to say, all right, who gets to set policy? Does the governor get to set policy? Does the Senate get to set policy? Or does the House get to set policy? You think about it, all of them come up with their own budgets separately. They decide what their priorities are separately. And yes, there's some communication between them. But ultimately, when it comes to teacher raises, And obviously there's a big difference in terms of the amount of money you're spending when it's 6% or 11%. But I think that you'd agree both are a significant raise,
sure,
particularly compared to past years.
Which were nothing.
Exactly. So you wonder, how do they get to the point where they're digging in their heels over these particular percentages? And I think really it's what it's about is who gets to be in control. One of the things we saw McCrory say before this session started was that he wanted to be more assertive. At the same time, he only vetoed two bills last year, and both of those were overridden.
Yep.
So I think that you see, you know, him trying to assert himself more as governor. What's his, you know, his legacy going to be as governor? What is how much control is he going to have over the policy? Obviously, you've got Tom Tillis in the House who's running for Senate, and then the Senate, of course. I mean, they're the upper chamber in this thing here, and there's. You know, I worked briefly for Congress, and the joke was that the other party was the opposition, but I worked in the House, but the Senate was the enemy.
Right. Well, it's good, interesting observations from you, Ben, and I guess we'll see. Who knows what's going to happen?
There's Ben Bradford yammering this segment.
All right, last topic. I got to play this again.
Yeah,
because,
bring it back.
All right, here we go.
Now, let's have a great big welcome for our host and hostess, Jim and Emmy Baker.
Thank you. Hello, everyone.
Oh, boy.
Why don't we have any segments start like that?
Oh, that's good.
Can we get something for Kevin for Morning Edition? Can we
Ladies
get
and gentlemen, wow. Kevin Gennison!
Well, listen to that.
That's all, you know, the old PTL, a Heritage USA site in Fort Mill, South Carolina. Much of it is gone now, or it's been divided up and developed into other things, but parts of it remain, and the big debate is, there's a big debate over what to do with the big tower that... unfinished tower that was built on the property in the 80s, and it's really interesting. Our intern Nick De La Canal got into it. It was interesting because he really hadn't heard of the Bakers. He's 21 or so. I don't know how he came across this story, but he had no concept really that Jim and Tammy Faye Baker were such a big deal and a big controversy in this country in the 80s, and the subject of so many jokes, so many of legal controversies. It was interesting to watch him put this story together without that initial historical perspective.
You know, it's interesting that you say that because I hate to break this to you, Greg, but I don't know about Michael, but I had no idea either.
I had no idea.
You're talking to two people. Jeez. You're talking to two people who were not aware of what was happening in the 80s. They were either busy not being born in some cases, or
guilty.
Or busy.
Although I snuck in 89.
Yeah, right.
I'm not going to make myself sound too young.
Yeah, or busy toddling around in my case.
So what did you learn from this story then? What stood out to you? I'm curious. There's a dispute over what to do with this big tower and there's a new ministry on site called Morningstar Ministries that wants
It sounds like a mess.
Turn it into a retirement
home. It sounds like a mess. You know, I think that one of the things that's great is, you know, if you go to our quick plug, you go to the website, WFAE.org, and you go there. Well, obviously, they're there if they're listening to us talk. But the picture on there of – Nick's got this picture of this, you know, Disney-looking castle with graffiti all over it. And you can hear him talking the story. He, like, points out, he's like, there's a tree growing out of the roof. And this idea that – this thing got handed off, this project, that there was this kind of grand idea from Jim and Tammy Baker that they were going to build am I wrong?
They were
going to
have more of a
Disneyland?
Hotel.
Yeah. Christian Disneyland.
Yeah, right. Well, and parts of it was. I mean, they had a big wave pool and everything,
right.
And this was going to be a key part.
And you were going to be able to buy a lifetime membership for $1,000, and then you were going to be able to go every year for three nights and stay in this luxury hotel and experience the thing. And it turns out that, of course, that all played into the scandal where Jim Baker was... it came out that a woman who had accused him of
Jessica Hahn.
He was paying her off. The idea, but this thing never got built. But now you come back to what's happening today, and there's this plan. I love the way that Nick says it in the story, which he says, you know, it's going to sound familiar. Basically, right. They're trying to build this, you know, series of. In this case, it's supposed to be more of a retirement community, mm-hmm. but you pay $1,000
to reserve,
and then you can to reserve, and then you get your spot in there. And it, there's still he goes through and you know he looks at you know what's happened over at the county council and he talked to the new kind of person in charge of this project. And it doesn't sound like there's a lot of details hammered down, despite the fact that despite kind of this big talk of what it's going to be like, he couldn't name who the construction company was that was working on it or anybody who was backing it in terms of finance. And these are big problems. I mean, when somebody's got a project of that kind of significance, they generally are able to answer some of those very basic questions like who is financing it and who is building it.
Well, it's caught up in a big legal mess. The Morningstar Ministries has filed a lawsuit against the county, which said it initially agreed to let them build it, but then Morningstar says it never heard back from the county, and now the county won't let them build. And there's people calling for the tower to be burned, to be blown up or torn down.
I love that.
Websites.
Multiple websites.
Yeah.
Multiple
tear down
websites.
TowerNow.com or something like that,
blow up the tower.
TowerNow.com. And the county is kind of more now in favor of doing one of those things, not blowing it up, but tearing it down, it seems.
I like it. I think it looks iconic.
It's fat. So blast from the past, really interesting story. I encourage you to listen to that down our website, WFAE.org. And that is another edition of WFAE Talks. Michael, I think you passed the test. You did a good job.
Hey, thanks.
Give me
Ben,
a six.
Ben, don't talk.
I'll give you a six.
All right, guys. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks, Greg.